was a sailor.
The planned lease sales come as federal officials seek to open more offshore acreage to drilling, a move that environmental advocates say increases risks to coastal ecosystems and fisheries. Meanwhile, energy policy shifts in Washington and Tallahassee are making ripples at Florida's biggest university. The University of Central Florida laid off 57 employees at its Florida Solar Energy Center, leaving only 7 employees at the research facility near Cape Canaveral. The state legislature designated that center as Florida's Energy Research Institute in 1975. But now, the university canceled its 50-year celebration and announced the layoffs, blaming sharp declines in external funding, from energy to lack thereof in the U.S. Senate. It looks like hundreds of thousands of health insurance holders in Florida will suffer sticker shock come January 1st. Efforts to save expiring federal subsidies for the Affordable Care Act insurance failed yesterday after Senate Republicans blocked the Democratic plan. Earlier, Democrats blocked a Republican proposal to replace subsidies with health savings accounts. Turning now to issues closer to home here in Sarasota, Manatee, property valuations on Longboat Key have dropped significantly in recent assessments, a development that local officials and real estate professionals say could influence future tax bills and market activity. As housing and taxes are in flux, infrastructure plans are also taking shape. Manatee County commissioners are moving forward on plans for a trash incinerator facility intended to reduce landfill use and produce energy, a decision that has generated debate over environmental impacts and long-term waste strategy. From county waste plans to downtown mobility, residents in downtown Sarasota are proposing a ride service solution to ease chronic parking shortage issues, suggesting apps or shuttles could help reduce congestion during peak hours and special events. For WSLR, I'm Stephanie Coachman. Stay informed, stay intentional, and as always, stay safe. Enjoy your weekend.
You're listening to WSLR 96.5 FM Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 Bradenton
in front of an audience of one real live cat. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who at the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini. Thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. Of course, the Venezuelan oil tanker seized this week in the Caribbean was the largest ever seized. But by whom? Or what? Or why? So many questions. I suppose that is one way, though, to divert attention from the clearly illegal executions of a pair of sailors labeled narco-terrorists who were struggling for their lives after a missile destroyed their boat. Now, that bit of film evidence has been relegated to the same drawer that once contained the Epstein files. Also this week, and it should come as no surprise to followers of the bizarre contradictions of the policies of the Orange Menace, that we, the taxpayers, are bailing out the farmers hurt by Trump's tariffs with what he says is the billions the country is earning from said tariffs. Oh yeah, isn't that tariff revenue ultimately paid by the end users, namely us, U.S. consumers? What a tangled web we weave when first we try to deceive. Meanwhile, early estimates of the payouts to farmers reveal a shortfall of about two-thirds. Speaking of governments making specious claims about the benefits of a policy, here in Florida, the governor and his legislative minions are proposing cuts to property tax, ostensibly to address affordability in the state. Stay tuned until half past the hour to hear my conversation with Esteban Santez, Director of Research at the Florida Policy Institute, who spells out the consequences of such a move. But first, yet another early election result is signaling a big blue wave come next November. Miami voters elected Eileen Higgins as mayor in a rout on Tuesday, choosing a Democrat to lead the city for the first time in almost 30 years in a race that Democrats hope sets a precedent for the 2026 midterms. Ms. Higgins, 61, will become Miami's first female mayor and its first non-Hispanic mayor since the 1990s. Cuban-American Republicans have dominated city politics over the past three decades. Together, we turned the page on years of chaos and corruption and have opened the door to a new era for our city, one defined by ethical, accountable leadership that delivers real results for the people, Ms. Higgins said in a statement declaring victory, promising to lead a government that finally earns the public's trust. Voters signaled a desire for change in the first round of the election in November, sending Ms. Higgins, a former Miami-Dade County Commissioner, and Emilio T. Gonzalez, a former Miami City Manager, to Tuesday's runoff. Both candidates campaigned on good government platforms following years of corruption scandals in a city controlled by political dynasties. Mr. Gonzalez publicly conceded on Tuesday evening as unofficial results from the county election supervisor showed Ms. Higgins leading by 18 percentage points. The outgoing mayor, Francis X. Suarez, who briefly ran for president in 2024, is term limited. Mr. Gonzalez said in an interview that he was proud of building grassroots campaign of volunteers after starting from scratch as a first-time candidate. I don't regret a thing, he said, adding that he called Ms. Higgins and wished her the very best as mayor. There might not have been an election this year without him. He won a lawsuit against the city after Mayor Suarez and several commissioners tried to postpone the mayoral election to November 2026. The move earned Mr. Gonzalez considerable goodwill from voters, though Ms. Higgins easily came first last month. Though Miami elections are technically nonpartisan, both major political parties were involved in the campaign. President Trump endorsed Mr. Gonzalez, and the Democratic National Committee helped Ms. Higgins. National Democrats flew in to campaign with her over the past few days, a striking development for a low turnout off-year election. Fewer than 37,000 votes were cast in the runoff. Miami, a city of about 500,000, is Florida's second largest by population after Jacksonville. Like the state, Miami has become more Republican over the past few election cycles, making a Democratic victory all the more striking. While Democrats slightly outnumbered Republicans in the city by voter registration, Republicans have excelled at getting more of their voters to the polls. This year's election broke that pattern, which Democrats see as an indicator of rising discontent with Mr. Trump and his party. Though local elections can be imperfect in measuring the national mood or predicting whether congressional districts might flip, national Democrats were quick to celebrate Mrs. Higgins' resounding win. Hakeem Jeffries, the U.S. House Minority Leader, wrote on X that the party is coming for the three South Florida Republicans next. Until recently, Ms. Higgins, a mechanical engineer by training and a former Peace Corps director in Belize, represented what she characterized as a Republican-leaning district on the city commission. She was first elected in 2018 after introducing herself to voters as La Gringa. Her blowout victory on Tuesday showed that she had built a diverse coalition of voters and crossed ethnicities and party lines. Ms. Higgins has promised to focus on solving residents' problems if elected. I'm a proud Democrat, but I serve them all, she said, in the broader in the broader electorate at Campaign Stop last week. If their streets are flooded, I want the public works projects that stop flooding. If they need affordable housing, I don't ask what political party they are before we let them make their let them take over an apartment. They're in need. Former DOJ attorneys in the Civil Rights Division are speaking out for the first time. More than 200 former employees of the U.S. Justice Department this week criticized what they call the ongoing destruction of its Civil Rights Division, saying President Trump's administration has abandoned its mission of protecting vulnerable Americans. In an open letter on the 68th anniversary of the division's creation, they allege that the Attorney General Pam Bondi and Assistant Attorney General Harnett Dillon have killed important cases intended to protect people from sexual harassment and assault, police brutality, and voting inequities. They also accuse leadership of changing how civil rights investigations are conducted by demanding they find facts to fit the administration's predetermined outcomes. Most of us plan to stay at the division following the 2024 election, but after witnessing this administration destroy much of our work, we made the heartbreaking decision to leave, they wrote in a letter which was published by Justice Connection, an advocacy group for DOJ employees founded by a former division attorney. Now we must sound the alarm about the near destruction of the DOJ's once revered crown jewel. The Civil Rights Division was established in 1957 by the 1957 Civil Rights Act. The law was originally enacted to help undo discriminatory Jim Crow segregation and protect the voting rights of black people. The Justice Department has said it's carrying out the agenda that Trump was elected to perform. A spokesperson in September said that the Civil Rights Division has been restored to its original mission of protecting constitutional rights of all Americans instead of pursuing a targeted political agenda against administration opponents. December 9th marked the first time that many former division attorneys have publicly spoken out since leaving the department. Robin Bittner, one of the letter's organizers, said the group hopes it will educate Americans about what is happening and inspire them to take action. We want American people to be our first audience, said Bittner, a former trial attorney who handles civil rights investigations involving discrimination against juveniles. They are people whose rights we are protecting. We want the public to know what's happening. Dillon has upended the division's traditional enforcement priorities and refocused them on Trump's executive directives. The division has nixed consent decrees that were in place to protect against police abuses such as excessive use of force and segregation in public schools. The weaponization of consent decrees ended when I took over the Civil Rights Division, Dillon said in a December 6th post on X. Since January, the division has lost about 75% of its lawyers, which the letter says was part of a coordinated effort to drive people out. The new priorities of the division are really rooted in partisan politics and not protecting the rights of all, said Reagan Brush, a former chief of the section that led civil rights investigations into police abuses. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. So now are we going to commemorate the life and times of Charlie Kirk with a special day? Agree with him or not, I still don't see what he did to earn such an honor. A debate on racism, sexism, and in-context quotations erupted this week over a bill that would make Charlie Kirk only the second person, after Ronald Reagan, to be commemorated in a Florida statute. Republican Senator Jonathan Martin would memorialize Kirk's birthday October 14th as Charlie Kirk Day of Remembrance. Comes 3 months after Kirk, 31-year-old podcaster and right-wing debater, was assassinated while speaking at Utah Valley University. It would slate him alongside Reagan as the only two people to have special observance day in Florida law. Unlike holidays, observance days don't allow for time off from school or are generally just a day of recognition for a figure or an event. I think that anybody who saw that video of Charlie Kirk getting at his last rally, Martin said before Senate Governmental Oversight and Accountability Committee, appearing to get choked up as he took a lengthy pause and cleared his throat, would agree that it was important to remember somebody who lived a peaceful life. He continued, I think that Ronald Reagan would be 100% okay with a Charlie Kirk Remembrance Day in the state of Florida. Following Kirk's assassination on September 10th, Vice President J.D. Vance canceled his 9/11 memorial visit to fly out west. A week later, President Donald Trump and top cabinet members spoke at his memorial service held at the State Farm Stadium in Glendale, Arizona. The political ramifications were massive. Teachers nationwide were suspended or fired for either applauding Kirk's death or publicly claiming that he was hateful. Some of the Trump administration, along with all of the Florida cabinet, supported visa revocations for visa holders celebrating his death. In Florida, pro-Kirk bills flooded in. Aside from Martin's legislation, Rep. Kevin Steele, candidate for chief financial officer, is sponsoring a measure to rename a road at every state university after Kirk. Senator Anna Maria Rodriguez and Rep. Juan Porras have proposed a Charlie Kirk Memorial Avenue in Miami-Dade County, and Rep. Yvette Benaroche is carrying an identical form of Martin's bill to the House. Although Martin emphasized that his bill was designed to signal to Floridians that political violence is wrong, Democrats raised concerns about some of Kirk's comments, which Martin claimed were spliced and out of context. They included quotes deriding Michelle Obama, Joy Reid, Sheila Jackson Lee, and Ketanji Brown Jackson as lacking the brain processing power to be taken seriously, claiming prowling blacks target white Americans, questioning whether certain black people received a job because of affirmative action, asking Taylor Swift to submit to Travis Kelce, and suggesting some gun deaths might be worth it to keep the Second Amendment to protect our other God-given rights. If you have to go through such mental and verbal gymnastics to explain away what this man said and how does he deserve a day of remembrance, Senator Tina Pawlowski asked. He was a provocateur. He was a podcaster. He did go on all these college campuses, and it's great that he was debating with people. That's what we do all the time. That's fine. But he's still responsible for his own statements, no matter how you try to justify it, she continued. He does not deserve this honor. The bill passed along party lines and will advance to the Education Post-Secondary Committee. ICE tracking app developer suing the government for removing the software from the Apple Store. The developer of an app used to share information about sightings of federal immigration agents sued the Trump administration this week, alleging free speech violations after Apple removed IceBlock from its stores. The lawsuit was filed in federal court by Joshua Aaron, the developer of IceBlock app that had over a million users before it was removed by Apple in October following pressure from the Trump administration, a rare instance of a tech company removing an app based on a complaint from the U.S. federal government. Aaron named Attorney General Pam Bondi, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, and ICE Director Todd Lyons, among other administration officials, as defendants. ICE agents have regularly raided businesses and other places to arrest migrants, even detaining them following immigration court hearings as part of President Donald Trump's immigration crackdown. People who oppose Trump's immigration agenda or who say they want to keep immigrants and others safe have used apps and other means to track and document ICE activities and warn people who might be at risk of being detained. Aaron said he thinks the Trump administration is just not attacking his free speech rights, but those of all citizens when it goes after apps like IceBlock, and that he hopes his lawsuit helps stop the administration from eroding the Constitution. When we see our government doing something wrong, it is our duty as citizens of the nation to hold them accountable. And that is exactly what we're doing with this lawsuit, Aaron said. The Justice Department and Department of Homeland Security and the White House did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Apple, which is not named as a defendant, also did not immediately respond to a request for comment. When it removed the app from its store, Apple said that it took action based on information from law enforcement about safety risks. The Justice Department confirmed that it had contacted Apple to pull the app, and Bondi said in a statement at the time that IceBlock was designed to put ICE agents at risk, which the developer strongly disputes. The app, which is still functioning for people who downloaded it before its removal from app stores, allows users to report publicly observable activity of federal immigration agents and their locations. Aaron, in his lawsuit, argues that the function is similar to what mapping apps like WAS and others do when they allow users to report the locations of police. The lawsuit says that Aaron submitted the app to Apple for approval and that it had been available through the company's app store since April of this year before being removed. Legal experts have told Reuters the surveillance of immigration agents is largely protected under the U.S. Constitution as long as people don't interfere with the agent's work or encourage others to do so. Courts have long held that recording law enforcement activities in public areas is legal. Aaron told Reuters earlier this year that his app in no way encouraged violence against federal agents and rejected accusations that it allowed users to dox those federal agents by noting this app does not allow users to upload any photos or videos. Instead, the app serves as an early warning system that was based on what was happening in public spaces, Aaron said, adding, "You can't limit what everybody can see with their own eyes." A Massachusetts Catholic church is coming under fire by some for its nativity scene. Leaders of a Catholic church near Boston kept the nativity display with an anti-ICE message in place this week, defying an order from the Catholic Archdiocese of Boston to remove it. The display outside St. Susanna Parish in Dedham, Massachusetts, includes the traditional shepherds, sheep, and wise men gathered around a hay-filled manger. But Mary, Joseph, and the baby Jesus are missing, replaced by a sign that reads, "ICE was here," in bold blue letters. "The Holy Family is safe in the sanctuary of our church," adds a smaller note inside the nativity scene, which is protected by a plastic shield. "If you see ICE, please call LUCE. The display includes the phone number for LUCE, an immigrant advocacy group which tracks the activity of immigration and customs enforcement agents in Massachusetts. ICE began a major immigration enforcement campaign in the Boston area in September, the forefront of a wave of similar efforts in other major cities. Speaking to reporters this week outside the brick church, the Reverend Stephen Josema said the intent of the display was to evoke dialogue, not cause a furor. He said the parish leaders would confer with leaders of the archdiocese before making a final decision on its fate. But he added that some do not agree with our display does not render it sacrilegious. Last week, the Catholic Diocese of Boston told the parish to take down the signage in its nativity display. In a statement, archdiocese leaders said churchgoers have the right to expect that they will encounter genuine opportunities for prayer and Catholic worship, not divisive political messaging. The statement also cited church norms prohibiting the use of sacred objects for any purpose other than the devotion of God's people. Todd Lyons, the acting director of ICE, added his own criticism in recent days, telling the Boston Herald that the nativity scene was absolutely abhorrent and part of a dangerous narrative, responsible for the sharp increase in assaults on ICE officers. Some members and supporters of the Dedham Parish said they were confused by the demand from the Archdiocese, which came 1 month after a rare and nearly unanimous statement from U.S. Catholic bishops condemning the Trump administration's aggressive immigration enforcement campaign. The display at St. Susanna on a busy street in a well-off suburb of Boston is the latest in a series of non-traditional nativity scenes staged by the parish. A version in 2018 sparked a similar controversy for depicting the infant Jesus in a cage, a scene church leaders said was a reflection on immigration policy at that time. A year later, the parish was focused on climate change, showing some figures of, some of the figures partly submerged in water. Catholics in Massachusetts tend to be more liberal than church members elsewhere, and many have defended the Dedham Parish. On the church's Facebook page, reaction to the nativity scene was split. Some commenters thanked the congregation for speaking truth to power, while others offered harsh judgments, including one assertion that the devil has infiltrated the church. Trump still doesn't like CBS and 60 Minutes. President Donald Trump this week attacked the new owners of CBS over a 60 Minutes interview with his former ally, Marjorie Taylor Greene, on the same day that CBS owners Paramount Skydance launched a hostile bid for media giant Warner Brothers Discovery. The CBS News program 60 Minutes on December 7th aired the interview with Greene, a Republican from Georgia, who in November said she was resigning from the House in the wake of a falling out with Trump. In a December 8th Truth Social post, Trump wrote, "My real problem with the show, however, wasn't how the low IQ traitor it was the new ownership of 60 Minutes Paramount would allow a show like this to air. They are no better than the old ownership who just paid me millions of dollars for fake reporting about your favorite president, me. Since they bought it, 60 Minutes has actually gotten worse." Trump also demanded the complete and total apology from the show and its correspondent, Leslie Stahl, for what he claimed were incorrect and libelous statements about a laptop belonging to former President Joe Biden's son, Hunter. CBS News did not immediately reply to a request for comment. Paramount Skydance on December 8th did make a $108 billion offer for Warner Brothers Discovery. Its $30 per share cash offer includes financing from Affinity Partners, the investment firm run by Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law. Paramount Skydance was formed in August after Skydance Media, owned by David Ellison, the son of Trump supporter and Oracle executive chairman Larry Ellison, took control of Paramount in a deal worth $8.4 billion. David Ellison helped secure regulatory approval for Skydance Media to buy Paramount with the promise that CBS Network would reflect the varied ideological perspectives of American viewers. Prior to the deal, Paramount paid $16 million to settle a 2024 lawsuit Trump filed over 60 Minutes interview with former Vice President Kamala Harris, which he claimed gave a distorted view of his rival for the White House. Before settling, CBS called the accusations meritless. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Up next is my conversation with Esteban Sanchez from the Florida Policy Institute.
I'm Lou Larini, and I'm happy to welcome Esteban Sanchez, Director of Research at Florida Policy Institute, which is an independent, nonpartisan, and nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing policies and budgets that improve the economic mobility and quality of life for all Floridians. Thanks for making time for us today, Esteban. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, great. First, just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to Florida Policy Institute.
Florida Policy Institute, right? Upon finishing my doctorate at the University of Central Florida, I studied public administration, which is the management side of government, and I wanted to find a way to get involved, not directly through government, but through policy. And for a policy institute, every year we publish an analysis of the state budget. And at the time, over five years ago now, they were looking for somebody to spearhead that budget process. And that's something that at the time I was teaching at the University of Central Florida, I was teaching fiscal management. So I thought that that was a good transition to also get involved in the policy space. So that's how I went, that's how I landed in Florida Policy Institute.
Yeah. Okay. All right, let's get to the subject at hand. Proposals have been made by DeSantis and the Florida legislature to cut or eliminate property taxes in the state. Cutting taxes always sounds like a good idea until the consequences are revealed. What would the consequences of even reducing property tax be?
Exactly. So, when it comes to public budgeting in the state of Florida or the localities, whether we're talking about municipalities, counties, special districts, or schools, if you eliminate a revenue source or severely limit that revenue source, you're going to have to make up for it another way. Nothing is free. So you're either going to have to increase another revenue source. At the state level, we could be talking about higher sales taxes, and that was part of the conversation at the beginning of the year. At the local level, we could be talking about new taxes as well. We could be talking about higher fees or cutting services or some other types of cost shift. But ultimately, if you were to severely limit, then you're talking about a cost shift. So this is not necessarily savings for all Floridians. This is just a new way to pay for the services they have now.
What are the sorts of government services that are mostly financed by property tax revenue these days?
These days, we're talking about public schools. We're talking about emergency services, firefighting services, police. Public safety typically is one of the main expenditure or spending areas at the local level. When you talk about your water, your special districts, you're going to have water and sewage. So those are just some of the collections, but you can even go to community centers, libraries, public parks, infrastructure. So we're talking road maintenance, really all the things that make our communities, places we want to live in or at. Those are the things that your local governments are paying for using things like property taxes. That's going to be the main revenue source at the local level. At the state level, our main revenue source is sales taxes.
Okay, yeah. And, what would it look like if, counties and cities, wanted to raise the lost revenue from property tax? What kinds of things would they do, and how would that affect Floridians?
They could try to increase sales taxes if they haven't maxed out their local option source taxes. So Floridians could be seeing higher tax bills at the cash register if they approve it. So these things would have to be approved by voters. They could try to increase fees, which is something we've seen in other states. So now you're paying a fee. They could cut services, which I think is probably one of the more likely outcomes at first. Before you can pass any type of revenue replacement, I could foresee some cut in public services. That's something we saw during the Great Recession with the collapse of the housing market back in 07, 08. So I think that would probably be the first outcome. And then there's also outcomes outside of government. I think last week, Realtor.com, they came out with a study saying that if you eliminate property taxes, they expect home values to increase by 8 to 9%. So So that means that if you're a Floridian trying to buy your first home, this proposal would actually make it harder for you to get into your first home.
Yeah, and that is an issue, even though there's like other things that I need to talk about. You alluded to it before about it seems like all the solutions to this, would be make Florida, which is already among the most regressive states in the nation, even more aggressive.
That is exactly. So, when we're talking about regressive, essentially we're talking about a tax code that overburdens or asks more from individuals who are making low to moderate income. In Florida, that would be individuals who are making less than $60,000 annually. They're paying more of their money. They're using more of their personal budget to pay taxes compared to somebody who's in the top 1%. And that's because we rely on things like sales taxes at the state level. And property taxes can also be regressive. And if you look at research coming from the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, Florida is actually number one. We are the most inequitable or regressive tax code in the country. And whether you eliminate property taxes and replace it with sales taxes, or you eliminate property taxes and replace it with a combination of cutting services for individuals or raising fees, that just simply exacerbates our position as the most regressive or inequitable state in the country.
Yeah, and just to be clear, and of course, correct me if I'm wrong, but I just read recently that the lower fifth, income earners in the state of Florida pay 13.2% of their income, taxes, while the wealthiest pay only 2.7%, and the top 20% pay only 4.5%. So, that's
exactly.
And I think it's important to point out that, folks that make $60,000 or less, that 13% of their income, is far more important than the 2.7% to the guy that's making $735,000 a year.
Exactly. I mean, that's the truth, and your numbers are correct. And we've had this issue. If you're looking at affordability today in the state of Florida, I think research from United Way says nearly 50% of Florida households are struggling to make ends meet. They do not have enough to cover the basic necessities of living in Florida. And on top of that, you have a tax code that overburdens the same individuals who are struggling. So I think there is room and in the conversation for relief. But none of the proposals around eliminating property taxes actually look to target the individuals who need it the most. Instead, they're all blanket solutions that also benefit wealthy homeowners, wealthy individuals who are currently benefiting from our tax code.
Yeah, I just read also recently that the governor's latest proposal, includes, some business about helping the most put upon, communities and municipalities with state surplus, to compensate for their losses in property tax. But I have to question whether that's a decent long term or a good long term solution. What do you think?
Beyond just whose plan it is, right? If the proposal is that we're going to tap into our reserves to try to target fiscally constrained counties or individuals who are struggling or who may lose out on revenue if we eliminate property taxes, using reserves at the moment is not advisable, particularly if you look at state forecast from the Office of Economic and Demographic Research. They're projecting that in 2 years' time, we're going to have a $1.5 billion deficit. And in 3 years' time, we're going to have a $6.6 billion deficit. I think since we're heading toward the deficit, we probably do want to have those reserves ready so that we can continue financing public services that people need. And on top of this, this does not take into account the impacts of H.R. 1, which passed July 4th of this year, which makes some cuts to Medicaid, to supplemental nutrition assistance, so that's just food assistance for individuals. And the state is going to have to make up for that, too. The reserves that we have, they're left over from just built up during the COVID-19 years that the federal government had programs and money flowing down to the state. I think that allowed the state to really build up reserves, but now we are going into a deficit. So if we're talking about the sustainability of using reserves to pay for this, it's not there, not with the current forecast.
Yeah, and that forecast that you quoted doesn't even include, cutting that revenue source, right?
I mean, exactly.
That's just, if we go the way it is right now, yeah. But the governor has also claimed that only 70% of property taxes are paid, claim that 70% of property taxes are paid by out-of-staters. So that cutting taxes on homestead properties shouldn't be that big of a deal. I mean, is that true?
I remember him making the statement, and I believe PolitiFact looked at that statement, and they did say it was mostly true. It's not, I believe the governor had estimated between 68% to 70%. The more accurate figure would be 64% is going to come from non-homesteaded properties and the rest is homesteaded properties. But even if you only focus on the homesteaded properties, that's still $18.5 billion. So it is a lot of money coming from just homesteaded properties that local governments will still have to make up. So, with the percentage aside, if we're focusing on homesteads, you still have to figure out how we pay for that. And as we mentioned at the top, that's a cost shift. The amount of money we're talking about, whether it's, completely eliminating for homesteads or eliminating it for non-school property taxes for homesteads, these things are multi-billion dollar proposals, and so far we have seen no way or no revenue replacement aside from, what we can tell, which is you're either going to see higher fees, higher taxes, or, inadequate public services.
Okay. Yeah, let me just interrupt for a second. We are listening to, Esteban Santez from Florida Policy Institute, and this is WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Another interesting thing interesting remark that the governor, made is that, property tax is like paying rent to the government on something that you own. Isn't that a little flawed?
Not to comment so much on, the governor's remarks, but
yeah.
I think there are different ways that typically in the tax world, in research, we talk about property taxes, and that obscures the fact that there is another way that you can view property taxes, and the way that most people experience them. It's not so much that you're renting for government, but rather that you're paying for the services that you're getting at the local level. And those services are the things that attract people to communities. So we mentioned those services, right? Public schools, your roads, your water, your libraries, your police department, your fire department, your emergency services, particularly during a natural disaster, for example. Those are the things you're paying for. So it really just comes down to, I think, it's not a matter of interpretation, but it's a matter of, I guess maybe it is interpretation, but ultimately I think the governor is focusing on the rent aspect, but not focusing so much on the benefits aspect, which I think it's more important.
Yeah, I just had to bring it up because, I needed to clear the air, for anybody who might have heard that.
Of course.
And thought, wow, that's an interesting take on that. I never heard anybody say that before, likening property tax to paying rent to the government, because it was always pretty clear to me the reason why I always had to pay property taxes. Because, I don't want to have to fix the road up in front of my house by myself. It's a lot cheaper, to have the county come do it,
It is a lot cheaper. If we were to just completely eliminate property taxes, I think that's another option. Are we going to privatize these services that currently we're getting through the public, through the public sector? And if we do privatize them, then how much is that going to cost? Is that going to be more? Are you going to have to pay a fee for the fire department to come to your home and put out a fire? These are the things we have to talk about. But currently, yes, property taxes, they they pay for those benefits that you're getting at the local level.
You know, and, you know, I mean, not to keep hammering on the, you know, governor, it's not him in particular. It's just, you know, his voice and things that he says as the, you know, leader of the state, but, you know, has, you know, still insists that, you know, there's enough waste, fraud, and abuse in local government that once that's all rooted out, you know, it's going to make this, you know, reduction, would make this reduction, if it goes through, you know, funding, you know, unnecessary. You know, it's just, you know, just got to, you know, clean up their act, the counties and cities. You know, they're wasting a lot of money, right?
We have 67 counties, 67 counties in the state of Florida, 67 school districts, and I believe over 400 municipalities. And then I don't actually have the number of special districts off the top of my head, but ultimately you're going to have a lot of diversity and a lot of, you know, preferences across these different local governments. That's why people move to communities. And when we say something like, or when we have a conversation about what is appropriate spending versus inappropriate spending, then we have to ask, well, what do you mean by appropriate, and who sets the standard for that? And then the question becomes, is the state going to set the standard for what local governments ought to do, or are local governments, who they do get input from the public? You have those budget hearings, you have elections, you have a way for people to get, you know, get involved at the local level. Are they the ones who are going to retain some of that home rule? And I think that's another aspect of the proposal. The idea of eliminating property taxes does erode or, you know, chip away at the home rule power of these local governments. It takes away some of that fiscal autonomy and then starts to shift it to Tallahassee, to the state government. So I think there is a broader conversation to be had here about who the decision maker ought to be when it comes down to, you know, what spending and what levels of spending local governments should have. But I think right now there is a level of accountability at the local government. People can get involved. If the proposition is we should get more people involved, I don't think I would disagree with that. But when it comes to thinking that we can root out, you know, waste, fraud, and abuse, then the question is, well, how are you defining that? You know, who gets to decide that? And I believe, you know, I don't believe that even by doing that, you would be able to cover the cost of eliminating property taxes. And even if that's the case, then you have to ask, you know, Floridians, which services are you willing to lose?
Yeah, you know, great point there too, that, you know, this might be, you know, yet another, you know, backhanded effort by Tallahassee, you know, to weaken, you know, home rule in, out in the States, you know, when, you know, everybody knows that the value of home rule is that, you know, your local government knows what that community's, you know, most important needs are. That community, like, you know, here in Bradenton, Sarasota area, you know, we have certain needs that are probably different than, you know, folks in Ocala or Orlando, you know, and we rely on our local government, you know, to make those decisions. So, you know, weakening of home rule is not a positive thing for residents. Okay, you know, in the final analysis, you know, if they put this through, you know, as we pointed out, the government needs money to operate. You know, where else could it come from? You know, and what would the consequences be? Well, the obvious one is raising sales tax, but, you know, even on a statewide level, you know, but how about changing the state constitution and instituting an income tax, you know, which would be, you know, sort of a progressive tax, but I won't hold my breath.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, for the listener, they are familiar with Florida's tax code, at least part of it. We know we don't have an income tax. We haven't had an income tax since, I believe, 1924, so over 100 years without an income tax. That leaves us very limited to how we can raise revenue to sales taxes and to property taxes at the local level. If you eliminate property taxes, The issue is that I have no. If you were to pursue something like a state income tax, that would still have to go and make it into the ballot, and there's no joint resolution, and I've seen no one call for that as a revenue replacement. There are other ways that you could raise revenue, but I would advise that you would raise the revenue to provide more targeted relief as opposed to just financing, widespread elimination. But you could do things like reforming our corporate income tax code by closing loopholes that allow corporations to essentially shift profits into tax havens. You could close all of these loopholes, not only in the United States, but also globally. And you could raise $2.4 billion annually, according to the Institute of Taxation and Economic Policy. $2.4 billion could finance a more targeted program. So you could close corporate income tax loopholes. You could create a tax using our documentary stamp tax that we have. You could create one that looks at high-value real estate transfers. Some people call these mansion taxes. But you could pick a threshold for, the value of a home, and you could start looking at that. A lot of the proposals today seem to be very comfortable with the idea that if Floridians were struggling, Floridians who are making low to moderate income, that they should pay more, thus making them more regressive, like we talked about. But there is the other aspect of it, the progressive portion. Not necessarily that you have to go through an income tax, which I think would be unlikely in the state of Florida, but you can have progressive options that ask individuals who have the ability to pay a little more or to just pay their taxes. So corporations, individuals who are buying mansions, if you pursue the mansion tax. Also, up until 2006, the state of Florida had what we call an intangibles tax. And that tax, up until 2006, would look at an annual tax on things like stocks, bonds, and other forms of wealth that, rich individuals, wealthy individuals hold. We could pursue that again. None of these options, though, would raise enough money to completely cover the elimination of property taxes. So I would, again, advise that these things finance a more targeted approach. I think those are some options. And then, obviously, we mentioned the sales tax, but we don't have to mention that one since we're focusing on more progressive options.
Yeah, because obviously, the sales tax, I mean, based on the numbers that, we've talked about earlier, would hit the, folks to make the least in the state, hardest because they pay most in sales tax because most of what they buy is taxed, tax, whereas if you're, of course, the guy that makes $735,000 a year, he still goes to the grocery store too, or maybe somebody does it for him, but he pays sales tax, but how much food can you eat, so
exactly, consumption is not going to be proportional to wealth. They're not going to increase at the same level, so their spending is not going to just because they're making $1 million, $2 million, let's say, they're not going to be spending $1 million, $2 million. And ultimately, there was also the point that you made earlier where, if a family who's making $60,000, $30,000 a year, if they find $100 in their pocket, that's a good day. If a millionaire finds $100 in their pocket, to them, that $100 bill does not have the same utility or same worth because they have so much. So, I think, but if we're going to talk about sales taxes really quick, I do want to kind of put some numbers here. If you were to eliminate completely property taxes, you would have to either double your sales tax, that was our estimate, or the Florida Chamber of Commerce, they say sales taxes would have to increase to 14.3%, so more than double. And then if you were to eliminate property taxes for just homesteads, which is the proposal that I think is moving now, you would still have to increase sales taxes to nearly 9%, and that's according to the Florida Chamber of Commerce.
Wow. Okay. Well, on that note, I want to thank you, Esteban Santos, for making time for us today. And, tell us a little bit more. Tell us how my listeners can, learn more about Florida Policy Institute and the great research and studies they do.
Yes. So anyone can go to floridapolicy.org. we do analyses not only on tax and budget issues at the state level, but also criminal justice reform, safety net programs, healthcare, housing, the environment, and all policy related, all, as Lou, you mentioned, with the mission of ensuring that Floridians have the mobility and quality of life to truly thrive in the state of Florida. So check us out. We're going to be monitoring the property tax conversation. We've already published some reports on this. So if you want to stay informed, just give us a follow. And anyone can always reach out to me if you have any follow-up questions.
Fantastic. Thanks again, Esteban. You have a great day.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Apparently, gift shops in national parks are suspected of harboring unpatriotic materials and have been ordered to remove them forthwith. Wouldn't want to bum anyone out about how we got some of this land. National parks have been ordered to check their gift shops for items that support programs like diversity, equity, and inclusion and remove them. According to an Interior Department memo obtained by the nonprofit advocacy group National Parks Conservation Association, parks have until December 19th to review all retail items sold at on-site outlets run by partner associations and concessionaires. In keeping with the Secretary's Order 3416, the National Park Service is conducting a common sense review of retail items to ensure that our gift shops remain neutral spaces that serve all visitors, the Interior Department confirmed to USA Today. We're working closely with our partners to make sure this process is smooth and doesn't disrupt visitor experience. If any items are found to be inconsistent with the order, they're being removed from sale. Alan Spears, the Senior Director for Cultural Resources at NPCA, said that it's not that straightforward. This is along the lines of the ongoing effort to sanitize, soften, or erase history in our national parks, he said. In March, Trump issued another order calling on Interior Secretary Doug Burnham to take action to ensure that all public monuments, memorials, statues, markers, or similar properties within the Department of the Interior's jurisdiction do not contain descriptions, depictions, or other content that inappropriately disparage Americans past or living, including persons living during colonial times, and instead focus on the greatness of the achievement and progress of the American people. Brigham followed suit with his own order in May, and weeks later, visitors at the Cuyahoga Valley National Park in Ohio reported seeing signs asking them to flag anything that could be disparaging toward America or U.S. history. Spears questioned the need for the orders, saying, "It's all part of our story. If we've got books or interpretive material, signage, or even keychains that point out that it's a part of our national narrative, and I think those things need to remain in place," Spears added. He said, "National parks have enough to worry about without the gift shop reviews." Citing staffing shortages and maintenance backlogs and inadequate funding, he said, "Our National Park Service rangers should be managing parks, not censorship campaigns." The Interior Department asserted its commitment to remaining neutral and not promoting specific viewpoints. "Our goal is to keep the national park focused on their core mission, preserving natural and cultural resources for the benefit of all Americans," the department said. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Thanks to Esteban Santos from the Florida FM in Bradenton. Thanks to Esteban Santos from the Florida Policy Institute for making time for us this week. And stay tuned for Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman.